Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Quantum Criminals, Ramblers, Wild Gamblers, and Other Soul Survivors from the Songs of Steely Dan by Alex Papademos and Joan LeMay. Narrated by Michael Butler Murray. The history of jazz has been the history of people picking themselves up off the floor. Jeff Dyer. Where's jazz going? I don't know. Maybe it's going to hell. Thelonious Monk. Steely Dan. In terms of pure musicianship, I'd put them up against any current band you could name. Walter White. Breaking Bad. No hay banda. And yet, we hear a band. The Magician. Mulholland Drive. Donald Fagen and Walter Becker began writing songs together as students at Bard College in the late 1960s, and in the early 70s in California, they started a band they called Steely Dan. Like a lot of people, they felt their youth slipping away and the world tilting off its axis. But if it got to them, they tried not to let anybody see it. They released 7 albums before parting ways in 1981. They reunited in the late 90s, and in the year 2000, they released their first new studio album in nearly 2 decades. A 9th and final album followed in 2003. Walter Becker died of cancer in New York City in 2017. As of 2022, Donald Fagen continues to tour under the Steely Dan name. Jack, Do It Again. The first person you meet in a Steely Dan song is a guy named Jack. In the first verse of Do It Again, Jack kills a man in anger, and then evades death by hanging because it's the hangman's day off. In the second verse, Jack is undone by his devotion to a faithless woman, and then in the third verse, he's undone again at the poker table. Jack is both the first Steely Dan protagonist and the archetypal one. He's a loser, strapped to the karmic wheel, forever slipping out of one trap set by his own dumb desires and into another one, rescuing doom from the jaws of salvation. Over the ensuing decades, Steely Dan will rewrite this song again and again. They will sing about people who can't help driving headlong toward one form of destruction or another. People telling themselves they're doing something other than that, even when they know the truth. It's 1972. It's the third week of November. Practically no one knows anything about Steely Dan, who the members are, where they're from, what their haircuts look like. In 1972, people still experience pop music through the keyhole of pop radio. There is no MTV to illustrate it. No Wikipedia to make you an expert in seconds. There is so much you can't know. Steely Dan's first charting single, the first track on the first side of the first Steely Dan album, Can't Buy a Thrill, released this same month by ABC Records, is a song called Do It Again. The title is maybe the first great inside joke by 2 of modern music's greatest inside jokers. Their names are Donald Fagen and Walter Becker. They will be the only consistent members of Steely Dan from the early 1970s until Walter Becker's death in 2017. And Do It Again is a funny title in part because this isn't even their real first single. Their real first single, released earlier in 1972, has already come and gone, making so little impact that for decades afterward, it will be hard to say whether the record was ever sold in stores or simply pressed up and mailed to disc jockeys, who ignored it. The A-side is a song about Dallas, on which they let their drummer sing lead. Presumably it's Dallas, Texas, but in the song, Steely Dan do not seem to have strong feelings, or even impressions of the place. Dallas exists solely as a place for the singer to say goodbye to, because he must. He seems to feel okay about it. The B-side is Sail the Waterway, about a man who considers chucking it all to make a life on the sea. These were perfectly decent 70s rock songs about men and the allure of rambling, a fruitful 70s rock subject. In 1975, Dallas will resurface on the 8th album by the country rock band Poco. And around the same time, Denny Doherty of the Mamas and the Papas will record a version of Sail the Waterway. Eventually, technology will advance to the point that anyone with an internet connection can listen to Steely Dan's versions of Dallas and Sail the Waterway at any time. And by the time that happens, technology will also have made it possible for Donald and Walter, who will have written off the entirety of their first three 70s albums as juvenilia, and seem to almost mean it, to describe Dallas as stinko in an online chat hosted by CompuServe. Dallas and Sail the Waterway will never appear on a domestically released Steely Dan album or Greatest Hits collection. So Do It Again is and is not Steely Dan's first single, in that it's the first one they're willing to acknowledge. Donald and Walter will dwell comfortably in this kind of contradiction for the rest of their collective career. They will become a cult band whose catalog, paradoxically, includes at least a dozen enduring radio hits. Precociously jaded, they'll express their dim view of the present day in songs recorded on the most modern cutting-edge equipment available. They will embed blue-ribbon misanthropy in music designed to go down as smooth as creme de menthe. They're grumpy and untelegenic, and they fill their albums with songs about pedophilia and heroin. But their hits will be heard in contexts in which they'd never be caught dead. In 1978, 6 years after Can't Buy a Thrill comes out, and 4 years after Steely Dan quit touring, Donnie and Marie Osmond and a line of ice dancers will perform Reelin' in the Years at the top of an episode of their ABC variety show, pausing between verses to introduce special guests Ruth Buzzy, Buddy Hackett, and Suzanne Summers. Within a few months of its release, Do It Again will crack the top 10, but it enters the Billboard Hot 100 at number 98. It slips in through the side door of 1972, when most people are still busy processing new songs called Starman, Rocket Man, Lean On Me, Heart of Gold, Take It Easy, Oh Girl, Backstabbers, Tumbling Dice, Doctor My Eyes, and Let's Stay Together. Each of these songs feels in its own way like an announcement, a hard line drawn between the musical past and the present. If Do It Again takes a while to catch on, it's partly because Do It Again is less of a statement and more of an insinuation. The first four notes pull you in off the street, opening a curtain on a room where the musicians are already playing. The first minute of this song feels like a story already in progress, even before the singer opens his mouth. But it also feels like the story's been waiting for you, and now it can finally begin. The music tells you nothing about the people who made it. There's a solo played on something that sounds like a rusty sitar, Latin percussion, a wavering science fiction movie organ line. The song seems to come from nowhere, evocative yet uncommitted to any of the styles it touches on, psychedelia, country, the mambo. This band could be a gang of drugged-out longhairs, or a lounge act playing the indigenous music of casinos, for all you know. In the liner notes for Can't Buy a Thrill, Do It Again is described with the single word traditional, as if it's a standard. It isn't, but soon enough, it will be. It comes from nowhere. Anyone can pick it up and play it with the same degree of authority. So it becomes like a standard when it's still new. Do It Again will go on to be far and away the most covered of Steely Dan's hits, outpacing runners-up like Dirty Work and Ricky Don't Lose That Number, by at least 20 documented versions. Anyone can make it theirs. It becomes the common thread linking the repertoires of Richie Havens and Lydia Lunch, Falco and Smash Mouth, Filipino garage rock bands and Latin-leaning jazz combos. A funk band plays it like Jack's a blaxploitation anti-hero gunning for the man. In the 80s, a Eurodisco studio group braids together Do It Again and Michael Jackson's Billie Jean. But in that equation, Do It Again all but disappears, because if you put even a little Billie Jean in the pot, all you can taste is Billie Jean. In 1983, during a period of his life in which he's spending $1,500 a day on cocaine, Waylon Jennings will cut Do It Again on an album produced by his drummer. In the verses, his drummer leaves out a beat in each measure, giving the song an eerie, dragging feeling, like an undertow pulling at your ankle. Jennings sings Do It Again like he's lived every detail in it, like he's singing his own obituary into a mirror. 18 years after that, Tori Amos will put a cover of Do It Again on the B-side of a European single. She strips the song down to build it up from nothing. A drum loop, some kind of buzzer, a piano stalking the beat like a tiger in a darkened staircase, and Tori smearing the words around. The first verse bleeds into the second after the words, "You go back," as if to leave Jack out of this. When she says his name, it's like Tori is singing right to Jack, a Jack who likes to hear what a bad, bad man he's been. But then she starts laughing at him. Her voice gets bigger, until you realize the room she's singing in is just the inside of her head, that you're trapped in there with her, and that everything around you has been a projection of Tori all along. She has been the gunman, and the mourners, and the two-timer, the water and the hangman, and the wheel. As for Jack, all we know about him is that he goes back, that he keeps making mistakes like the ones he's made before. His name might not even be Jack. It might be Jack as in Buddy or Mac. Jack like the Jack who has to be told to hit the road. Jack as in Chief or Boss or Sport. The three verses might be about three different guys, or a stand-in for guys in general, as a category of person. Jack is not the singer of this song, but we don't know how the singer knows Jack, whether they're supposed to know each other at all. There is no I in Do It Again. There's an us down the stretch in the third verse, but it feels hammered onto the end of a line to make a rhyme for Vegas, the way the singer puts on a drawl when he sings the word singing, just to make it rhyme with hanging. As in so many Steely Dan songs, the singer stands outside the story, like when the camera pulls out during the cold open of a Twilight Zone episode, to reveal Rod Serling with his cigarette, saying, "Presented for your approval," or "Witness if you will," or "You are about to meet a hypochondriac." Except it's not quite the same. We're not just the audience. What the singer is actually saying in Do It Again is that Jack is you. In the first verse, you wake up in the morning and hunt down the man who stole your water. You shoot, you kill, you love and lose. You bet and curse the cards. You go back. You do it again. It's you making things worse and worse, and somehow not dying. There's no twist ending, no moral, nothing to take away. Just three set pieces about man's helplessness in the face of whatever tempts him. An open invitation to contemplate your own life, and whichever aspects of it might be futile in this same terribly cyclical way. This ice-cold ode to the inevitable is kind of perfectly representative of what Steely Dan will go on to do, of their preoccupation with human frailty and delusion, and the unsentimental eye they'll turn on it. But in 1972, you can't know any of this. Almost nobody does. In 1972, at the beginning of all this, people hear Do It Again on the radio and assume it's by somebody else, if they notice it at all. One day it comes on in Walter Becker's friend's car, and that's how Walter Becker's friend hears it for the first time. "Oh, far out! A new Santana single! the friend says to Walter. They're getting pretty good. Walter. Introduction. Adorable ghost. He's born February 20th, 1950. Walter Becker, a Pisces, from Forest Hills, Queens. He is the Steely Dan member most easily caricatured in the style of Charles Schulz, the little round-headed boy grown to sardonic manhood. But he's also in the mythos, the dark one in the band, the source of the music's edge, its ruthlessness, especially about people. The true bohemian, too. In 1974, in the pages of the music paper Zoo World, he's observed riding to soundcheck in the back of a convertible, whose broken top he's trying to keep closed, taking rain to the face and grousing, "I don't want to go to the soundcheck. I want to go home and listen to far-out jazz." 42 years after his birth, in the press notes for his first solo album, he finally offers this origin story, also involving cars and rain. Mr. Becker makes his debut as a music lover while huddled in the back seat of his father's cream and flesh-colored Ford Fairlane. As it hurtles down the Henry Hudson Parkway, he watches the advertising billboards slide by and is hypnotized by the rhythmic swooshing of the wipers and the mottled half-light shining through the rain-swept windshield. He begins to enjoy the bland but tuneful renderings playing on the dashboard radio. In his life as a working musician, he'll play bass and some guitar, and much later he'll sing. But his first instrument is the melodica, a sacred sound in reggae, the plastic woodwind instrument Augustus Pablo carried with him to meet King Tubby uptown. Although the first time Walter sees one on television, the musician playing it is talk show host Steve Allen. After that, Walter tries the tenor sax. It doesn't take. When he hears Bob Dylan, Walter starts saving money for a guitar and a harmonica. Walter grows up believing his mother is dead. In 1965, his father, who sells paper-cutting machinery, has a heart attack on a plane and dies shortly thereafter, following another one. Many people in this story are dead now. This is partly because much of this story takes place a long time ago, when people knew less about which things could potentially kill them or were more able to pretend they didn't know. Also, though, people just die sometimes. In 1997, a man named Randy California is pulled out to sea while rescuing his son from a riptide in the waters off Molokai and is never seen again. Before that, he has a bunch of hits as the singer of the rock band Spirit. Before that, he plays in a band with Jimi Hendrix in Greenwich Village, and Jimmy gives him the name Randy California, because another guy in the band is Randy Texas. Before that, he's Randy Wolf. He lives next door to Walter in a Forest Hills apartment building called the Balfour. He teaches Walter a bunch of blues licks. When Walter is 17, he enrolls at Bard College in the town of Annandale-on-Hudson in upstate New York. One day he's playing guitar in a campus coffee shop, and in walks Donald Fagen, wanting to meet whichever Bard kid is in there playing like Howlin' Wolf. They play together in a couple of student bands, with names like the Bad Rock Band and the Leather Canary, sometimes with a drummer named Chevy Chase, whom they'll later describe as having been one of the funniest drummers they worked with, but maybe not the funniest. Chase will go on to cultivate a comedic persona so cool and ironically removed that many people find him difficult to connect with emotionally, which is also a problem many people will have with Donald and Walter's music. Maybe it's a Bard College thing. But Donald and Walter also start writing original songs together around an upright piano in the common room of Walter's residence hall, Ward Manor. Donald's first documented song is called "The Bus Driver is a Fruitcake." They'll keep at this for 40 years. They'll call their band Steely Dan. They get it from a book. In 2017, the guitarist, Steve Kahn, who played on Steely Dan's Asia and Gaucho, and then on a lot of Donald's solo recordings, told Billboard that he once asked Donald what it was exactly that Walter did, and that Donald replied, "He finishes the things that I can't seem to finish. It could be a line in a song, it could be a missing chord somewhere." And maybe that explains why, after Walter dies, Donald starts telling people he maybe can't write anymore. Walter dies on September 3rd, 2017, at 67, 4 months after being diagnosed with cancer. The cancer that kills him is esophageal cancer, which is the same kind of cancer that killed Humphrey Bogart, Philip Larkin, and Sylvia Kristel. A few months after Walter's death, his widow, Delia Becker, says in a statement that his diagnosis had been a grim surprise. It's the one phrase in the statement that sounds like a Walter line. It has the ring of a pulp mystery title. The final volume of a series, maybe. One more battered paperback on the shelf, joining Fire in the Hole, The Royal Scam, Black Friday, and Everything Must Go. Delia Becker also says Walter was cremated, per his wishes, without ceremony or memorial. But a memorial had already taken place, in September, on the internet, as soon as the news of Walter's death broke. In a statement, Donald recalled his longtime writing partner as cynical about human nature, including his own, and hysterically funny. Later that day on Facebook, Donald and his wife Libby Titus posted the lyrics to a song by the Eels, Dead of Winter, the one about cancer and the cold night and the little flame in your lighter as it goes out, the one that calls death the unfinished line, and dedicated them to Walter. On Rolling Stone's website, Ricky Lee Jones wrote a long, beautiful, unflinching essay about what it was like to know, collaborate with, and occasionally clash with Walter, who took jobs producing albums like Jones's Flying Cowboys as part of rebuilding a life and career he'd nearly lost to drugs in the early 80s. Walter's generational and actuarial peers posted about him. Paul Stanley from Kiss, Ben Montench from The Heartbreakers, Nile Rodgers from Chic, and Bootsy Collins from Outer Space via P-Funk. But so did Roots band leader Amir Questlove Thompson, who called Walter an artist's artist, and producer Mark Ronson, who called Walter one half of the team I aspire to every time I sit down at a piano. Opening for U2 in Detroit that weekend, Beck paused to observe the passing of a rock and roll hero after slipping a few bars of Josie into Where It's At. It went on like that, tribute after tribute, from likely and unlikely fans. Best Coast's Bethany Constantino and Brian Adams, Mac DeMarco and Slash, Julian Lennon and John Mulaney, Judd Apatow and Just Blaze, not to mention countless regular people testifying that they too had been shaped, or warped, by Walter's music. And of course, this is what always happens when somebody famous dies. And of course, it's because we live in a splintering culture. And when we get together to mourn somebody, we're really mourning the passage of one more piece of our shared understanding of the world. And of course, nothing spikes a celebrity's stock quite like death, which summons forth, from the woodwork, casual appreciators and posers, in it for the likes, who are all shattered by the news, and want you to know it, because nobody wants to admit they slept on an icon. But in Walter's case, the outpouring of posthumous sadness and appreciation revealed something. At some point between the release of Do It Again and The Grim Surprise, Steely Dan, who'd always presented themselves self-deprecatingly as a marginal band, had stopped being truly marginal. The sadness was just so discombobulatingly unanimous. It was as if half the planet had sung out, "Is there gas in the car?" And the other half had responded on cue, "Yes, there's gas in the car." They had been a popular 1970s rock band for a while, with a bunch of songs that made the charts and rock and roll never forgets. But then they stopped being a band for a while and fell far enough out of fashion that it became possible to discover them again and experience them like a secret. In 1988, after moving to Norwalk, California, to work as a psychiatric nurse technician at the state mental hospital there, John Darnielle found tapes of Katie Lyde, Asia, and Gaucho at a local record store. Spent much of the following year scrutinizing these albums as a jeweler might inspect a rare gem. And soon thereafter, began writing and recording the first songs he'd release under the name The Mountain Goats. Many of them recorded live by a Panasonic boombox, including an anxious 1995 cover of Steely Dan's FM. After the breakup of his art rock band, Gastrosoul, the Chicago multi-instrumentalist, Jim O'Rourke, started making albums of experimental MOR music, like 1999's Eureka, taking influence from aspects of 70s music that punk had rendered off-limits, and picking up where Steely Dan's avant musac had left off. The Farrelly brothers curated a soundtrack for the 2000 film Me, Myself, and Irene that included Steely Dan covers by Ivy, Ben Folds 5, and Brian Setzer, the way that Something About Mary used Jonathan Richman, inexplicably but enjoyably. A few years after that, egged on by his Dan-loving collaborator Vernon Reed, the writer and musician Greg Tate and his band, Burnt Sugar, rearranged Steely Dan's catalog for jazz rock orchestra. And of course, hip-hop has never stopped rediscovering Steely Dan's fount of samplable groove. From De La Soul rapping over the hook from Peg, to Kanye West building Champion around a line from Kid Charlemagne. In 2019, 2 years after Walter Becker died, with the Danissance in full swing, the online music magazine Pitchfork commissioned retrospective reviews of some classic Steely Dan albums from four other writers and me. These days, Pitchfork, founded by a recent high school graduate in Minneapolis in 1995 and sold to Condé Nast 20 years later, covers everything from experimental noise to high-gloss chart pop. But the site made its name in the early 2000s as a top-of-the-bookmarks menu resource for fans of a certain strain of guitar-based indie rock, lo-fi in spirit and aesthetic, if not always in execution. There was a time when devoting this much virtual ink to revisiting the catalog of a band like Steely Dan, especially without a new album or a tour or a reissue campaign as impetus, would have been antithetical to Pitchfork's sense of itself. That time was the year 2000. If you search Steely Dan's name in Pitchfork's review database, you'll find my piece on Gaucho, along with four other pieces that ran during Steely Dan Week, but you'll also find the only other Steely Dan review Pitchfork has ever run, Brent DiCrescenzo's savage hard pass pan of Steely Dan's eighth album, Two Against Nature, which at the time was the first new music they'd released in 20 years. DiCrescenzo was an early fan favorite among Pitchfork's writers, but his byline hasn't appeared on the site since 2004. Any trace of his hyperbolic, pseudo-gonzo approach had been purged from Pitchfork's house style long before Condé Nast entered the picture. So his Two Against Nature review, a vitriolic 1.6 out of 10, is a time capsule of how Pitchfork used to read. But it's also a snapshot of how negatively Steely Dan were viewed at the turn of this century, particularly by people whose tastes and values were shaped by late 80s, early 90s indie rock. If you are a diehard Steely Dan fan from back in the day, DiCrescenzo begins, let me first congratulate you on figuring out how this whole internet thing works. There are two separate ponytail jokes in the first paragraph alone. In the four graphs after that, Two Against Nature and its overall aesthetic are compared to late-period Rush, a Daniel Lanois-produced collaboration between the Dave Matthews Band and Kenny G, and the evil robot spider Will Smith blows up at the end of Wild Wild West. The last lines are an admonition to any present-day listeners still thinking of cultivating a hip musical crush on Becker and Fagen. Remember, DiCrescenzo writes, this glossy bop-pop was the indifferent aristocracy to punk rock's stone-throwing in the late 70s. People fought and died so our generation could listen to something better. Okay, so they died of overdoses and car crashes. They still had soul. Keep up the good fight.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?